the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Welcome, everyone. Hi. Sorry we're starting a little late. I guess the plenary, I don't know if it's even finished yet, but the plenary went a little late. And so it's almost 11, and we've been given the green light to go about 15 minutes late in our session as well. So hopefully the room will fill up. We're limited to 300 participants, and we thought we'd have to fight people off at the door, so that might still happen. But welcome, anyway, to the session, People Living with HIV/AIDS, a Positive Force for Prevention. It's really great to see you all. I just wanted to give you a little overview of what others believe. I believe. A little overview of what we're going to try to accomplish today in our 90 minutes. It's a big topic, but let me just give you a little rundown of the purpose of the session. So what we want to do is review the existing science base, not in a really rigorous way, but at least get a brief overview of the science of prevention interventions which are aimed at people living with HIV. And we want to identify key principles for the provision of prevention services for people living with HIV. So these are the outcomes we're hoping to achieve. We're hoping that as participants, you'll gain the opportunity to share some of the existing best practice and key principles on prevention for people living with HIV. We hope you'll have a good understanding of how to apply the GIPA or the greater involvement of people living with HIV principles in the context of HIV prevention. And we hope that we'll be able to identify research directions that are needed to enhance the messages and approaches for prevention with people who are living with HIV. So before we discuss the process, I just want to introduce all the people on the stage up here with me. This is Isabel McKinnon, and she's our professional facilitator. We've been really privileged to have her help design the session and facilitate the session. It's, as you can see, it's a little different than all the other sessions, or many of the other sessions at this conference, in that we're really, pardon me, Isabel McKinnon. We're hoping to have a little bit of a different format where we put first and foremost participant dialogue and your own expertise, and then we have a panel of experts who will actually respond to what you have discussed and weigh in with their own perspectives. So we have three highly esteemed experts on the panel here. We've got Believe Diliwayo, Mary Jane Rotherham, and Neil Self. And I'll just let you know who they are. In brief, Believe has worked extensively and intensively with community-based AIDS service organizations in Africa, and he's a very passionate believer and supporter of the GIPA, or MIPA, the Meaningful Involvement of People with HIV Principles. He's the founding member of the Zimbabwe Activists Against HIV and AIDS in Zimbabwe, and he's a member of the Pan-African Treatment Access Movement and the International Treatment Preparedness Coalition. He's currently a board member of the HIV/AIDS Legal Clinic of Ontario, and as well as a consulting coordinator for Atheno Treatment Support Network based in Toronto. He's conducted trainings, seminars at universities and colleges aimed at prevention for HIV infection among young people in Zimbabwe, Zambia, South Africa, and Kenya. He's a person living with HIV. He's open about his status for more than 11 years. He's a community-based HIV activist, a trainer, and a qualified systemic counselor by profession. Believe is married, so all those single people out there, sorry, he's taken, to Lusungo, who is an AIDS activist as well, and they have three children, two boys and a girl. Welcome, Believe. Next to Believe, we have Dr. Mary Jane Rotherham-Boris. She's with the University of California in L.A., and she's a professor of child psychiatry and behavioral sciences. She directs the Global Center for Children and Families and an HIV center funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. She has designed and evaluated interventions for HIV-positive adolescents, adults, and families in the United States, South Africa, Uganda, China, and Thailand. Six of the prevention interventions she developed have been selected by the U.S. CDC as evidence-based programs that really make a difference. Dr. Rotherham Boris has authored or co-authored over 210 journal articles, including those published in Science, JAMA, and the American Journal of Public Health. And she's received over 40 grants from the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Institute on Drug Abuse to study HIV prevention with high-risk adolescent and adult populations. So thanks for coming, Dr. Rotherham Boris. And last but not least, I have my fellow Canadian, Neil Self. He's a current member of the Board of Directors of the British Columbia Persons with AIDS Society, where he chairs both the Positive Prevention Standing Committee and the Support Services Standing Committee. He currently volunteers his time with the BC PWA retreat team, and he took the lead in developing, coordinating, and implementing the serosupportive workshop for HIV-positive and HIV-negative couples. He has previously volunteered with the Cranbrook AIDS Society, the Vancouver Pride Line, and the Advocacy Office in Vancouver. Neil has been positive since 1990, and like many HIV-positive people, he reevaluated his life when his health improved in the mid to late 1990s. He returned to university in 1999 and completed his BA in 2003 and a Bachelor of Social Work in 2005. He's been accepted into the Masters of Social Work program at UBC, University of British Columbia, in September of this year. He lives in Vancouver with his partner Jason, and they've been in a serodivergent relationship for 10 years. So thanks for coming, Neil. So I'll hand it over to Isabel, who's going to explain why you're all sitting like this and what our process is going to be.
Thank you, San, and welcome. Okay, so what are we going to do? At the moment, you're all sitting in groups of 10 or perhaps a bit less. And in a minute, the whole room is going to be talking. We wanted to flip it round because we felt it was important that you, the delegates, have a chance to start sharing your experience around these questions. You're going to be talking about five different questions about prevention interventions aimed at people living with HIV. The purpose of this is really to get the discussions going. And you're probably seeing now all the different colored sheets. So there is a group of circles, people here who have a blue sheet, and that is question one. And question two is the green sheet, I think, at the back, and then three is red, and so on and so forth. These questions complement each other, and we'd like you to talk about those. So the process we're going to be, what we're actually going to be doing, is I'd like to ask you to have a conversation together for about 15 minutes, for exactly 15 minutes. And in order to do that, well, if you're a large group of 10, it might be an idea to identify a facilitator. The key thing here is it's not about getting the answers. It's about generating, sharing a little bit of experience and ideas. There is no right answer. It's about you sharing your own experience. And we'd like you to write on the back of the sheet, just before the end, a key point. And we'll be hearing a selection of those key points. So if you flick it around on the back, you've got a space for a key point and also some email addresses. So I'll give you a little notice 3 minutes before the end of the 15 minutes. Just choose one point that you think is important in your group. And then San will ask to hear about those at random. And we'll be typing those up so you can see them here. After that, our presenters here will be listening and responding to that and taking that into account when they give their presentation. So that's just the main points. Your facilitator will guide the task. And our speakers are also going to, the reason we have it open like this is the speakers will come and join you and listen in a little bit whilst you're speaking. So I'd like to run through the questions with you, just so everyone has an idea of what the main questions are. And I wonder if I could ask each of those speakers to read one of them. Are you all linked up? Can I start with Neil? Oh, Believe, you go first. Neil, you go. I think it should be on.
What is the most effective way to engage peers in promoting or implementing positive prevention strategies?
Thank you. And question two.
What is one important way that healthcare providers, community support workers, can work with persons living with HIV to reduce risk behaviors and maintain safer practices?
Thank you, Mary Jane. And Sam?
And question three is, what is the one message that PHAs must communicate to other PHAs with respect to reducing the number of new HIV infections?
Okay, question four, the white sheet is, what is one research question or issue that needs to be addressed with respect to the interface of HIV treatment and prevention?
And question five on the orange is, what is one recommendation you would make in terms of meaningful participation of people living with HIV in prevention? So, 15 minutes. Have a conversation. Write down your key point. If there's anyone alone, please, or if you'd like to join up with others, please shift around. And your 15 minutes starts now.
If I could have your attention for one moment. My name is Lalita Krishna, and just want to let you know about the filming crew that's out here. We're making a short documentary on the youth participation in this conference, and Lena here is one of our subjects, so we are confining ourselves to this group, and they've all consented to being filmed, just so all of you know that. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. If you now have about another 3 or 4 minutes, so could you choose a key point and write that onto the back of your sheet? And then we'll be coming back to share some of those in about 3 or 4 minutes' time.
Okay, everyone, we're going to wrap up our group discussions, and we're going to do a really brief report back. So hopefully you have your one or two key points. And I'm going to randomly pick groups to report back. Within 1 minute, I want to hear what your key point is. Okay, so it's very brief. And there's microphones number 1 and 2. You can run up to the mic, or I might just hand you the microphone. Okay. Let's go over here to these lovely gentlemen. And they're still talking. Who's reporting back? So this is the white group. What is one research question or issue that needs to be addressed with respect to HIV treatment and prevention? Are you ready to go? Okay. Let's go over here. One key point.
We're still working it out. I start with another group that already knows what they're going to say. Okay. Well, we've got a few points over here. I wish we had more time to talk. But one of the points that we can summarize, it seems to be the last thing we talked about here, is to get people who are living with HIV and AIDS into meaningful participation in prevention. One of the things that seems to be important to all of us culturally, we come from many different backgrounds in this group, is instead of dwelling on the negative impacts of what it means to live with HIV and AIDS or what the stigmatic impact is on others, the mixed messages about AIDS is no picnic, but it's also something you can live with, maybe what we should be getting back to is what is beautiful about being a sexual being, and what our rights are and what our responsibilities are in protecting ourselves and kind of lessening that dichotomy of the difference between an HIV-positive individual and an HIV-negative individual and simply looking at us as human beings.
Okay, I'm going to go over here to a research group. You're talking about research, right? So what's one key research issue?
One issue that came up for us was the question of when your viral load drops to undetectable, do you really have to keep using condoms when you're in a permanent relationship or an intimate relationship long term? with someone who's in a discordant relationship. So what is the actual risk? Do I have to use condoms for the rest of my life?
Great. That's a good one. Let's have another research issue.
All right. Well, we also, I mean, I'm sure all of us here, we come from different backgrounds. We have different experience. But I think the one thing that's come up here is that there needs to be an integration between the prevention and the treatment work. I know a couple of us have mentioned it, but there seems to be two different movements. There's a movement of trying to do the prevention. And there's a movement of working with treatment, working with the infected. And there needs to be a marriage between these two. People that are working with treatment and people that are working with prevention need to work together, because I know from where I come from in South Africa, the prevention programs, the people, the awareness campaigns and the media campaigns, it's almost perpetuating the stigma, because they're saying, don't get HIV, don't sleep around, use condoms. And this message, the underlying message that is being put across, is that people with HIV are bad. And there needs to be an integration between these two movements for us to have a broader picture of success. So I think that's the one thing that came up with us.
Thank you very much. Are you gentlemen ready? That's a handsome
group. Hi. We talked about disconnection. That came up a lot in our discussion. And two points in particular came up, and it was the disconnection between treatment and prevention. Where does care and support finish and where does treatment begin? Where does care and support finish and where does prevention begin? And how do you actually connect these two things? And we were a little unclear. And there were several thoughts about that, but we didn't actually come up to any consensus. And the other point was around how prevention for positives exclusively causes a disconnect within community, that is, between positive and negative. And we were talking about the need to integrate prevention between positive and negatives.
Thank you. And make sure everyone you're writing down, even if we're not capturing your points in the oral report back, make sure you capture it on your sheets. We're going to be collecting them, writing them up. If you've put your email address down on the back of the sheet, you'll get a report of all the points that were brought up. So make sure you write them down if you want them to be shared. So here's a big red group. What did you guys talk about? Your question was around what is the one message that PHAs must communicate to other PHAs. So you have a point?
Yeah, I think we had a very hard time with this question. It was unclear whether what was exactly being asked, because we felt like you would communicate with other PHAs but also be communicating with maybe folks that aren't. So I think our consensus of the points, we had a great discussion, I think, was to encourage and support people to live their lives as they would otherwise, and so that positive people can show others that this can be a very normalizing experience, and that this should just be the norm of just something else that folks live with.
And I should just mention Ron Rosen, as the conference co-chair, is madly typing up there, so thanks, Ron. It's nice to have you here. Okay, question on the blue sheet is, what is the most effective way to engage peers in positive prevention? Who's got a main point?
So we talked about the populations that we work with within this group, and we're a small group. So some of what we talked about was with working with youth. Many of us work with youth, and we were also like the red group. We weren't clear whether we were talking about HIV positive peers or all peers. Some of us here work with survival sex workers in Vancouver as well, so we were saying in that population of women,
you really need to engage everybody to, you know, to make it meaningful. The point that we came up with was by utilizing existing networks, you need to engage the population from the very beginning. And one of the things we talked about, everything from logo design to the name of the project, everything needs to needs to involve the population you're working with and empower the population to be involved in every aspect.
Promote the message about what being a PHA is all about, how it works, and how prevention should work.
All right, we've got a green group. Can you remind me of the question on green?
So we dealt pretty much with healthcare providers and what people can do in the health field to help. And the two points we came up with were de-escalate fear in healthcare providers by providing education. And then the second one was providing positive education to support persons making decisions in an empowerment manner when they're on their own. It's when they leave the doctor's office.
Another green group?
Okay, we had a hard time coming up with just one key point, but we narrowed it down to that the healthcare provider should be a resource that provides hope, empowerment, just focusing on that it's the patient's choice, being approachable and non-judgmental, providing accessible tools, education, support, while incorporating different strategies at different times. Thanks.
That's a good catch-all. Pardon me?
Incorporating different strategies at different times.
Thanks, Ron. You're doing a good job. We're testing Ron's typing skills. Okay, we have time for one more over here, the red one.
We're from the red group, and our question was about the message that people, HIV-positive people, must communicate to other people living with HIV/AIDS with respect to reducing the number of new HIV infections. We discussed lots of aspects of the lives of people, and we discussed internal stigmatization and sharing responsibilities and safer sex and positive prevention. And finally, we got to the point when we decided to put it in one message, a real message. So, and that is, don't stigmatize yourself. Live full life, enjoy safer sex, use condoms, clean needles, and care for others.
Somebody was waving madly over here. Orange group. You don't have 2 minutes. Don't write it down. Just say it.
Our point is HIV-positive people should be trained and educated to do prevention for themselves, then for others as peer educators. They need also stable life conditions. That is, they have to have jobs. They need to be empowered. Because life doesn't stop with being HIV positive. And then they can be role models, and nobody can do prevention better than HIV positive people themselves.
Okay, last chance. Oh, green back there. What's green again?
Okay, ours really follows on from the last one, that what healthcare providers and community support workers can do. And we agreed that the best thing that we can do is enable and support PHAs to offer peer support in a safe, supported, confidential and consistent way, both individual and group. And that our job is to build trust and relationships, to know it may take time.
Thanks, everyone. And let me just remind you that all of your points will be captured as long as they're legible and on the back of one of those sheets. And please put your email addresses down. So I'm going to hand it off to our presenters. Believe is going to speak first.
I'm realizing that most of the things that actually have been captured within the groups, some of the points that have been raised from the discussions in the floor are basically coinciding with exactly what I have on the few slides that are there. I'll look briefly within, I think, 10 minutes time on the peer-based approaches to prevention with positives. And I just want amongst the group to acknowledge the presence of my one fellow comrade from Zimbabwe, Lina Chimanzi. She's been one very young woman, very courageous and bold to be in a position to be where she is living with HIV. I'm remembering where she's coming from and where she is now. And I think we need individuals like her who are bold to come out in the open and being young and engage themselves in prevention. So one of the things, one of the points that I heard from the floor was creation of safer space. So it's creation of enabling environment. One of the things that has really worked is engaging individuals from the communities and creating a safer space where they can actually share their experiences. And so we are talking about prevention there. And I think that's one key thing that is very important. And when we talk about prevention from peers to peers, it starts when there is an enabling environment where they can actually share their experiences. The second thing that, again, I heard it from the floor, was to do with building capacity among its PHAs themselves. It is not only the capacity from program planners that should be taken into cognizance, but it is PHAs themselves who can basically mentor and train other PHAs to take care of themselves. I know that a participation certificate to some of you who are social workers and who have got PhDs and so forth. A participation certificate does not mean a lot, but it really means a lot to a community-based individual who has never been to a college or has never been to a university. And the mere fact that they were able to be there for 3 days or for 5 days to share their experiences and be given an opportunity to go through the process that is such that they will be in a position to reflect that which they have learned. It's really, to them, it's really rewarding. And it's a motivating thing that they will have the rest of their lives. So training and building capacity, it's one of the things, it's an approach that we could actually use for prevention from our peers to another peers who are living with HIV. And when we talk about condoms, condom usage, risk reduction amongst peers, as much as we appreciate the technology, as much as we appreciate the issues being explained by doctors with regards to safer sex, harm reduction, I think it's better done by us living with HIV than being told by someone who's not living with HIV. Because we've got the experiences of living with HIV, and we know what it is like getting infected and having to live with HIV. And so we are better in a position to explain that. One of the things that has been happening in Zimbabwe, train peers in terms of how condoms should be used. I'm just showing you slides of pictures of peers living with HIV. I talked to them before I came here about their concern. They said it's fine. So they are engaged right now in training other peers in terms of better ways of using condoms. Unfortunately, up to today, we still have got a gap in terms of condom use. What we have more is the male condoms and the female condoms. They are still not as widely available as they should be. And I'm sure there it's still a gap with prevention. And that takes away the right of women to decide about safer sex issues. And I'm sure when we talk about time to deliver this conference, we're talking about female condoms. They should also be made available. So sharing experiences as well. Sharing of experiences is one way that would scale up our prevention as well. The other thing is peer-to-peer counseling. There's a point that was raised that was very interesting with regards to where do we start? How do we talk about where does treatment starts? How do we talk about prevention messages? When do we link the two? So when individuals are encouraged to uptake voluntary counseling and testing, there is space for them to confidentially share issues that are arising with them, and they are empowered to critically look at issues that are arising. And it is such that through that process, also gender sensitivity can actually be taken into consideration, where you have women who are living with HIV especially are not comfortable sharing their experiences with men because she might be coming from an abusive relationship. And to go and face and talk to another man might bring a reflection of what she went through. And as such, the best approach would be having a female or having a male or having someone of the same sex whom they would feel comfortable with in terms of confiding, and basically having this individual taking them the whole process of coping with issues arising with them. So the use of responsive model, there's a point that I heard from the floor that we should actually be sharing responsibilities within families. And I'm sure sharing responsibility does not only end within a family setting. It runs down to institutional level. Those are a group of pastors, and we're trying to strategize to look at what is it that we can do in a church setting to scale up our prevention messages within a faith-based community. So the other thing also will be about mobilization and providing education. And this can be better done by people who are actually living with HIV. After challenging the pastors that they were supposed to go and do something about the setting up of support groups in their church-based communities, there's been a number of support groups being set up within a faith-based agency up to date, because we challenge them to do so. And I think this is the best approach that we should actually take in terms of setting a pace in getting prevention messages being get over across by PHAs to other PHAs as well. And then, of course, prevention, when you talk about prevention and when you talk about a best peer-based approach, we are talking about, I think, drugs and food, period. In developing countries, people living with HIV and AIDS, the biggest issue with them right now is not about coping. They know their status, right? We are tired of talk. We want the food, we want the drugs. If the food cannot be sustained to be supplied, we need mechanisms, we need strategies that are such that we can have as takeaway home, and then we can have gardens that are sustainable. We grow vegetables. There in the picture there, we are seeing individuals having to get some food, and we've got from Zimbabwe what we call Zundera Mambo, where people would actually grow some food, get it together, and then they share it within the village. We've got also another phenomena that we have actually developed collective that is known as Pan-African Treatment Access Movement. And all what we are saying is we need access. We need the drugs. And I'll talk a little bit more about that subsequently. And that's another way, again, of prevention. What are the lessons learned? People living with HIV and AIDS are as much good caregivers, as much as social workers. It's not about going to school that matters. It's not about going to college and being taught how to take care of someone living with HIV. What I have found, that which has been most useful over the years that I've lived with HIV, it is only an issue of just going there and sitting and just having someone in your presence living with HIV and listening to them talk. To me, that is what inspired me to live with HIV to be where I am today.
And I'm sure most PHAs, they've got people that have inspired them to live to be where they are. And so HIV individuals are experts in taking care of each other, and they need to actually to be, their capacity will need to be built. Holistic care and support. So when you talk about holistic care and support, we're talking about there should be adequate food. But it is not only the food, because I know that individuals are putting emphasis on food, but it is also emphasis on management of opportunistic infections and talking about the drugs being available for prophylaxis. We are talking about taking care of self and all those issues are lessons over the years that we have learned after from the 20 years that if someone is eating well and there's provision of drugs and they exercise well, they can live for a very long time. So what am I recommending to you? That which can be best practice. So when you talk about accessibility, it's a major, very important. Affordability, acceptability, and also availability. All these are important. And of course, we continuously would join hands together, the young and the old, to advocate that we need people to be treated now. Thank you.
Thanks, Believe. So we'll leave some time at the end, I hope, to have some questions maybe amongst the panel members, as well as if any of you have questions or comments for the speakers. Mary Jane, can you go next?
Sure. Slides. Now is the time to deliver on the mountains of scientific evidence that we have, that we've been gathering for the last 25 years, to improve the lives of 21 million HIV-positive youth who need care now. In the time that we're sitting here today, 360 young people have been infected with HIV. And another 360 have died. This year, 2 million were infected. Next year, 2 million are going to be infected. These 21 million HIV-positive youth need care now. And it's the people in this room, the HIV providers, who can dramatically improve the lives of HIV-positive youth. Yet we find that every community invents its own solutions slowly over time. As I was walking around the groups this morning, I heard about a program in Ohio, and I thought, gee, this is exactly the same program that I know about in South Africa, in Cape Town, and the same program that I've seen in daycare centers in Thailand. Every community is reinventing their own solution, as every donor has reinvented their own solution slowly over time. So that it's taken us 25 years to reach a funding level for 70% of what we need. And that we know in the next 2 years, it's going to be 40% more than what we need today. It's gone slowly. But my role here today is to talk as a researcher. Every researcher reinvents their own solutions slowly over time. It took us 12 years to come up with the first prevention program with evidence for people living with HIV. Now we have 150 evidence-based interventions, and 25 of them are for HIV-positive people. And I was tasked to talk about youth today. We have five programs, evidence-based programs for youth. We brought you the list of the 25 programs. But how many people living with HIV are getting these programs? About 1%. My message here today is that in those 150 programs, evidence-based interventions, which have been published and evaluated independently, that there are common proven solutions that are common across every one of those evidence-based programs. and that our job now is take those proven solutions and broadly adopt them and tailor them to your local community. It's actually much easier, I think, than what we think, in the sense that I don't care where you are globally, Asia, Africa, South America, all HIV-positive young people face four challenges that are always the same. You have to do something about your health. You need to stop transmission. It's likely that you're going to be depressed and feel some despair, so you need to build a high-quality life that focuses on living with HIV. And you've got some very predictable challenges. Disclosure, losing income because you're ill. How are you going to take care of your kids while you're ill? These challenges are highly similar. And while the challenges are similar, the answers, the solutions, need local adaptation. But based on those 150 programs that we have, those 25 evidence-based programs for HIV-positive people, my message here today is that we have a roadmap. Every single one of those evidence-based programs share three characteristics. There's a set of common components. Everybody who does it well does it the same way. There's best practices. And everybody uses the same strategies or common learning principles. They're the same. And if we went to analyze them, we could come up with these common factors. Again, we've provided a summary of that to you in the back. What do I mean by common components? Well, I was really happy to see beliefs. First main point, if you don't address environmental barriers, you're going nowhere. You can't expect condom use unless there's access and availability to condoms. You can't encourage circumcision unless there's a safe surgical environment. First, you have to take care of the environmental issues of what your program is to be about. But the second issue is, how are you going to frame that? This entire conference is about how we frame and how the world wants to see HIV be framed, not as an issue of despair, but as an issue of hope and encouragement and a celebration of what we've done. To me, and we heard one of the groups here today, HIV prevention for positives needs to be framed as an issue of living with the disease, not desperate or dying. The most brilliant example of framing an issue for me is the Sonoguchi Project in India. That in the last week, this was written about as a program that really is about empowerment for women. Today, it is. It's a trade union for 60,000 sex workers that's global. But that's not how this was framed, and that's not why it was successful. The Sonoguchi program is about sex work is work. It was an occupational health program. And it was not, and it was framed, and it only succeeded not as an empowerment program, but it was a fiscal monetary incentives to the people who controlled the sex workers. A very high status Brahmin went and sold the brothel owners, the police, and the political parties. If your women get infected, your profits are going to go down. And so in the first 5 years of that program, it was the brothel owners, the police, and the politicians who demanded 100% condom use among sex workers. It wasn't about empowering the women. How we frame the issue depends on whether we'll be a success or not. Third component, providing information. If your goals, if you're an HIV-positive pregnant woman, you need to know about ARVs, you need to know about testing your baby, you need to know about you need to know about only one feeding method. Every pregnant woman needs to know that. There's specific information depending on your goals. But that's not enough. We need skills. And the meta-analysis of evidence-based programs say we need active, participatory environments where everybody does the same thing. The challenging situations that positive people are going to face are very predictable. Everybody's going to face stigma. Everybody's going to face disclosure issues. And the skills are feelings, thoughts, and actions. And if you can find those predictable situations and help people anticipate and practice what they're going to feel, think, and do in those situations, they're going to succeed. Finally, every evidence-based program builds support. That's been a big theme today, and we've talked about peer-based programs. I want to play the devil's advocate for a moment, and it doesn't matter how you build the support. Anonymously on the internet, in communities, in couples, in families, among gay men, in support groups. But our group actually has learned a number of lessons about some of the cautions about peer HIV-positive peer-to-peer issues, especially for young people. When we've looked at peer-based programs, we've seen that it's often a problem that young people who are peer leaders, especially since they're so young, they're having trouble taking care of their safer sex and their drug use behaviors. And sometimes these young peers lead the guys they're supposed to be helping into trouble. There are also role conflicts. They're your clients, but in fact, now they're supposed to be the counselors. And how do they come to you? Are you their boss or are you their counselor? These are challenging issues that I think as we endorse these peer programs, we need to think about. But once we've attacked those prominent components, there are organizational, there are provider level, and there's client level best practices that all of you practice if you're successful. You have to have programs that build on strengths, not deficits. If you have a punitive, controlling, authoritarian staff member, it's going nowhere. You need to frequently reward people if you expect them to change their behavior. Everybody knows best practices, but we often don't specify them for people. And finally, everybody learns the same way. How do people change their behavior? They change it with new opportunities, in relationship, with practice, and over time. I don't care whether you call that social learning theory, self-efficacy theory, theory of reasoned action, health belief model. It's the same way that people learn globally. These principles are a roadmap that are present in every evidence-based intervention. Now, if we have that roadmap, the challenge is, how are you going to tailor that roadmap to your local condition to change the lives of HIV-positive youth? We have strategies for how to do that, and it's been done in hundreds of communities with rapid ethnography to tailor those elements. And then we can experiment and encourage a wide variety of delivery formats to deliver the same messages, skills, and framing. It can be on the internet. It can be in individual sessions. We provided some examples from our evidence-based interventions. We tried it out in individual sessions, in small groups, on the telephone. It worked all three ways. What we're doing today as an example is we took our 300-page manual for mothers living with HIV and we took that manual and changed it to DVDs, to daily planners, to very different delivery formats. It's that kind of experimentation with the roadmap that can begin to change. For us today, our real challenge is will providers and researchers implement broadly and quickly evidence-based solutions. We've been moving very slowly while HIV-positive youth die. If we adopt proven solutions and then tailor that roadmap to your community, what I would argue today is that you can and will improve and save the lives with evidence-based care for young people living with HIV. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary Jane. I'm going to turn it over to Neil Self now from BCPWA.
Good morning. I would like to thank San and Isabel and the organizers here for inviting me to talk at this wonderful conference and this exciting symposium. I've been asked to speak for a few minutes on about prevention in the context of serodivergent couples or serodivergent relationships. And I use serodivergent here is because when we sat down and talked about, everybody else here at this conference is using serodiscordant. But when we sat down and talked about this, serodiscordant just sounded like the couples were fighting all the time. So that's why we've got serodivergence. It means the same thing. I'm going to speak. I've been asked to speak from both the northern perspective and from the perspective of an organization that currently has programs or services in the area of positive prevention. Just to give you a little context about BCPWA and our positive prevention department, BCPWA, or the British Columbia Persons with AIDS Society, is the largest HIV and AIDS organization in Western Canada. We have about just over 4,300 members. And while it's notable that our board of directors are all HIV positive, it is really the committee structure of our organization that ensures that all of our members have direct input and into the development and policy and procedures of all of our programs and services. And while most of you probably know what positive prevention is, I have provided a brief reminder. It focuses on tertiary prevention efforts are directed towards people living with HIV and AIDS and are intended to reduce the negative or challenging effects of the illness and maximize the quality of life. The picture presented here is one of a series of posters that our positive prevention department developed some years ago and marketed in the It's Complicated campaign, a campaign that encouraged both positive and non-positive people to discuss their status. This particular campaign was directed at the MSM community. With respect to serodivergent relationships, there are very few supports and services. Just to give you an example, in British Columbia, which has a population of about 4 million, of course, we have 4,300 members, and we've got about a third of the whole HIV population in our membership. There's one support group that allows couples, allows the partner of a couple to be involved. So one in the whole population. Yet we have evidence, thanks to a study by Remian and all et al. In 2003, that partners of HIV-positive individuals have higher levels of psychological distress as compared to the general public. In fact, it is similar to the distress experienced by HIV-positive individuals. Clearly, there is a potential need for couple-focused intervention services or supports. And what about prevention campaigns aimed at serodivergent couples? Again, there's not a lot that I could find, at least in the North American context. It appears that serodivergent couples' relationships and safer sex practices are taken for granted. It seems as soon as you hook up, you're on your own. Most of our efforts are focused on the single or individual in single environments, i.e. gay men and sex environments, or specific groups like intravenous drug users or sex trade workers. A perfect example is our campaign. It's Complicated. It was targeted at men who have sex with men in sex environments. Yet, the SexNow survey from the Community-Based Research Center in British Columbia in 2002 found that half of positive gay men that were in relationships were in serodivergent relationships. So that's 25% of our population are of positive gay men. Now, there was no data in BC on opposite-sex couples, but findings could probably be extrapolated. And in fact, when we ran the serosupportive workshop, half of the applicants were same-sex, the other half were opposite-sex. One of the discussion questions for the groups was, what is one research question or issue that needs to be addressed with respect to the interface of HIV treatment and prevention? I would say we need to ask, what supports and services do serodivergent couples need to maintain a healthy and serodivergent relationship? In other words, how can we support them in staying healthy and staying together? As far as the BCPWA response, we developed a serosupportive workshop, which is a 3-night, 4-day residential workshop for serodivergent couples. It is designed, coordinated, and implemented by a team of HIV-positive individuals. Another discussion question in the group was, what is the most effective way to engage peers in promoting or implementing positive prevention strategies? I would say including positive people in developing and implementing prevention strategies is critical. And this is not tokenism either. This is not do a focus group with you, and we'll run off and do the program. This is getting them involved right from the start, right through the whole process, and right through the evaluation. Also, we should actually apply, in the evaluation aspect, we should actually be applying Fetterman's empowerment evaluation principles. In terms of specialized help, again, another discussion question from the group was, what is one important way that healthcare providers or community support workers can help work with PHAs to reduce risk behaviors and maintain safer practices? Again, I think we need to support PWA-directed efforts and prevention strategies. We need to provide outside expertise as required or be the links to these external resources. In developing the seropositive workshop, we had assistance from BCPWA staff, bodywork practitioners, counselors, prevention experts, and a community-based research technical assistant. The seropositive workshop was designed as a springboard to develop other supports and services or identify prevention challenges, things like support groups, social groups, forums on health and treatment, such as a possible forum on how couples can work collaboratively to address issues of adherence or management of side effects. Or perhaps we can enlist the couples in the design of a prevention campaign directed at serodivergent couples. And in the discussion room, there was a couple other points on this as well. One of the points from the group over here was the focus. You need to focus on groups that are like-minded. The example given there was queer-positive women. We did that with serodivergent couples. And we had an amazing experience in that when we got 21 serodivergent couples from all over British Columbia together in one room for the information session, it was just an amazing buzz going on. I can't explain to you here. I can't put it on a slide, and I can't explain to you. But just having them all in the room so they're in the same area in a safe environment was just an amazing thing to watch. We conducted a needs assessment at the information session for couples interested in attending the seropositive workshop. We had 18 couples from all over BC, and here they listed their top five responses to the question of what issues are of importance to them. There's no surprises with the top three, my partner's health, my health, and quality of life as a couple. But fear of becoming HIV positive or my partner becoming HIV positive suggests that there is continual concern on the part of couples, and that these fears need to be addressed either through prevention education or support services such as support groups and counseling. Couples prevention needs on the workshop range from basic HIV 101 for newer couples to more advanced discussions on harm reduction techniques. Intimacy is a common theme among HIV serodivergent couples. This issue is often tied to the issue of prevention in that we know that as many couples gain intimacy over time, the perception of risk decreases and unprotected sex increases. Again, Remian provided much of this work as far back as 1995. Sexuality is tied to prevention in more than the obvious ways as well. In the newer couples, they often cite more pleasure-seeking motivations for non-condom use rather than intimacy. Both of these issues were brought up by couples on the seropositive workshop, and healthy discussions ensued. The picture actually here is of a peer-facilitated small group session where the individuals, all these issues were raised by the individuals. Of note, in this session, we actually divide the couples by sero status for this, so that the facilitator here is positive, so it's a positive environment all around. And in the negative groups, we had a negative facilitator. As far as providing peer-based programs and providing role models and inspiring couples, many couples experience breakthroughs or what one couple referred to as magic moments, either around communications, understanding their partner's emotional needs, or in more practical terms, prevention information they just didn't know. The picture here is of a couple that has been together for several years and had a magic moment during the communications wheel exercise that we did. Younger couples were also inspired by long-time couples. Several couples were inspired or encouraged that other couples could maintain a long-term healthy relationship and remain serodivergent as well. This type of prevention message is probably more effective than any social marketing campaign that we could develop. Likewise, several longtime couples reported that both their relationships and their commitment to prevention was reinvigorated by attending the workshop. And there were actually two levels of role modeling going on. There was one amongst the couples themselves, and another between the positive participants of the HIV positive participants that attended and the HIV positive workshop team. Positive participants in the workshop were impressed that other positive people could produce the workshop. Two members of the actual 2005 seropositive workshop have been invited into the workshop team as advisors for this year's workshop. And there's room for them to come right onto our team and work with us in all our other projects as well. Again, one of the discussion questions discussed in the groups was, what is the one message that PHAs must communicate to other PHAs with respect to reducing the number of new HIV infections? Well, with respect to serodivergent couples, one important message is that it is possible to stay healthy. It is possible to have a healthy long-term serodivergent relationship, and that supports are available or can be made available by positive people themselves. And just quickly, I just went over some of our outcomes delivered. We delivered a formal prevention session there. We also established informal prevention dialogue and role modeling. We did a lot of consciousness raising, community building. We established an informal support, social network, and we got support group potential. This particular group that we decided not to run a support group this year, but that option is always there for them, and they know that. And we also gained advisors on future leadership workshops, so we've done some leadership building as well. Now I'm just going to shamelessly plug my poster presentation on the seropositive workshop, where I can discuss the nuts and bolts of the workshop itself, the origins, the development, and implementation and evaluation. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Neil. Now, before the room clears, we do actually have 10 more minutes because the session started late due to the plenary extending into our time. So we've been given the thumbs up to go a little bit longer. So if anybody has a question or a comment that they'd like to make to the panel, please go to the one of the two microphones, number one or number two. If you keep your questions and comments brief, then we can have as many people participate as possible.
Hi, I'm Bruce Dick. I work with the World Health Organization in the Department of Child and Adolescent Health. I've got a question for Mary Jane. I was wondering, first of all, what were the outcomes in terms of the evidence-based programs that you were working on? And secondly, I was very surprised in your core components to see information and skills, but not services.
We would have put services like access to health care as an environmental barrier that you had to make sure that you had. We've had multiple programs for children and families. So let me take our family-based intervention. At 2 years, for both the parents and for their children, we had reduced depression, reduced anxiety, fewer sex and drug behaviors, both by the adolescents and by their parents. At 4 years, we had relapse on those behaviors, but in fact, parents were injecting drug users and they relapsed into substance use less often. At 4 years, adolescents were more likely to stay in school and less likely to initiate sexual risk behaviors. At 6 years, and they had fewer babies. Teenage mothers, teenage pregnancies. At 6 years, the parents were, again, less likely to relapse into substance use. The adolescents had less conflict in their romantic relationship. Do you want me to go on and on? And their grandchildren had better home, were better adjusted. These are babies that weren't around when the intervention was started. Their grandchildren were better adjusted and tended to have higher IQs in home environments. Teenagers, less sex and drugs, more likely to be assertive with their doctors, and fewer mental health symptoms over 2 years.
Could you please explain how that relates to HIV-positive people and what is the health outcome in terms of HIV-positive people? Because you're talking about a big community, as a big family, as all of them were HIV-positive. So if you could be more specific in the evidence base for a prevention intervention that give health outcomes to HIV-positive people.
currently today, in terms of health outcomes for HIV-positive people, one of the primary focuses has been on sex and drugs. There's been a study with adults, healthy relationships, which is IMPRESS. There have been multiple studies with adults. There's been on reducing transmission. The maintaining health outcomes are not in terms of AIDS or not AIDS, CD4 counts, or viral load. They're about behaviors of how you relate to your doctor, adherence to medical regimens, and adherence to ARVs. And there are multiple evidence-based interventions for that.
Okay, let's take a question from microphone 1 and 2. We'll take them both at the same time, and then we'll have the panel respond to them.
Yeah, I think, my name is Lucky Mazibuko from South Africa. I'm a journalist. I'm also a person living with HIV. And I just want to express a bit of a problem, because as someone who has experienced discrimination both at racial level and also at HIV status level, I find it unacceptable that, I mean, all the speakers, the panelists, and almost everyone else who has spoken, so we seem to wish to discriminate against others. I mean, everything that we talk about is restricted to people living with HIV, and I find that unacceptable. I think that it is important that as people living with HIV, who most of us have experienced or are afraid of being victimized and discriminated against, I think we should be the ones who are setting a precedent in terms of acceptance of others who may be different from us. Thank you.
Thank you. Microphone 2.
I'll be very brief because you just stole my point. My name is William Fleming, and I just wanted to note that early we heard a point about trying to overcome the difference between positive and negative. And practically speaking, that's not easy to do, and there's lots of reasons why bringing people living with AIDS to the forefront is important. So I don't want to start an argument. I just want to raise that in the presentations, I saw a few opportunities where we didn't actually recognize that many caregivers, you could say probably most caregivers, are not positive, and yet we didn't talk about them as an asset and a very vulnerable group. So I also want to thank you for the presentation, for involving the last presentation, both for its focus on the divergent couples, which I think is important. I mean, you could extrapolate that to the world and our interplay with one another as negative and positive, but also for the practical focus on sex and the way that most of us do get infected and bringing that to the forefront. So I would encourage all of you, and anything you want to reflect on, about how to stop the kind of positive-negative separation that we all further in our presentations and in our work, unfortunately.
Would any of the three panels?
Actually, I'd just like to say, I think this is a huge and very important point, and I know the way we translate it is we think, as actually Neil also said, people have focused on populations, gay men, IDU. I know our center now only predominantly focuses on families or communities, and that then in the context of a large extended family, there's positives, there are negatives. This is a family challenge to have a high quality life every day for all of them.
Neil or Believe, do you want to respond?
Yeah, just maybe reacting to what my brother from South Africa was saying, that I think we need to be more accommodative. I think over the years, what we have seen, there's been a lot of top-down approach, which has been such that people living with HIV and AIDS have not been given a space to express issues arising with them as people really who are burdened with the disease. As much as they would love to be accommodative, but it's the level of interaction has been so much restrictive. And what we are trying to say is the peer-based approach will be such that these individuals are given a space that they can freely express issues that are arising with them, and with capacity being built, it is such that they will learn to be as much accommodative as possible. I'm sure what we see most people living with HIV being passionate about issues that are emanating from, because the GIPA principle is not being taken into cognizance effectively, and that's a huge piece with PHAs, and they are passionate about that, and as such, they tend to, we tend sort of to be like more, we are not accommodative of people who are negative or program planners, but it is for a very long time
That is, there's been that huge gap, and we are trying as much as possible to involve program planners. We need to be involved as well. We need our journalists to be there with us, and we need to discuss these issues collaboratively rather than having people planning and discussing them on our behalf.
Neil, did you want to add anything?
No.
Okay, one last comment, and then we'll have to wrap up.
Hi, I thank you all for your wonderful presentations. And I was observing in the small group process and in some of what happened in the room today, a sense that I'm feeling some of the history repeating itself, as it generally tends to do, and your comments about how slowly things are changing, Mary Jane, I think are very clear and evident over the history of this. And I think one of my hopes is that as we proceed, that we don't do another broad brushstroke. It's taken us a very long time for some people to catch on that the role of people who are HIV positive in prevention is probably the best, most important thing we could do, and we've been way too slow getting there. I hope that now, though, we don't just draw that stroke too broadly and say, okay, positives are in prevention, that's what we need, and that's enough. I think we always have to remember the collaborative needs between the expertise in behavior change, the social workers and psychologists, the behavioral scientists who can help those who are HIV positive become better efficient agents of change by teaching about whether it's behavior change, the stages of change, theories, the other theories around there that talk about how to make your programs comprehensive. Because otherwise, I think we again proceed very slowly. Now we've got the message, people who are HIV positive are critically important in this process, but at the same time, we need to come together with the behavioral scientists, the social workers, the psychologists, the families, and work as a better team, I think. So I just hope we don't, because I saw some of the answers from some of the groups were, get people together, you know, get peer support. Yes, but I want it to be sort of high-quality peer support that's empowered and informed through the behavioral science so that we don't treat the whole group as being at the same stage of change. Some are in pre-contemplation, some are ready to change, and on down the line, so that it's not just a support group, but a group that helps help people identify who they are and where they are in their own attempts to change, and so that we can then help them get to the next stage. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. So I think we're going to have to wrap up, and I just want to really thank the panel, Neil, Believe, and Mary Jane, as well as Isabel, and thank you to all of you who've stuck around the last few minutes.